Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for the middle of August. I think it's the 14th. Yes, it's the 14th of August, which means that August is almost over. And,
so is our vacation.
Our vacation is almost over. We have a few more days. One more week left. You have to preach next Sunday.
I know.
How does that make you feel? Poorly. Sad. So we thought we would do a camping roundup and do some commentary on the news stories of the week.
People were saying that I was forcing you to go camping because I loved to camp and you obviously didn't, but
yeah, well that's
not the case.
No. I forced you to go camping. I had to really prod and nag for months in order to get that camping trip out of you.
Right, because
and then I had to make you feel bad because you only wanted to go for 4 days. You tried to make it, you tried to cut days off, and I had to get you to add them back.
Right, because camping is irrational. You take a whole bunch of stuff and you go out into the woods where there's mosquitoes and bugs, and You everything that you do in 5 minutes here, you do in an hour there. So cooking, we had nice meals every day. We didn't just go buy, you know, pre-made meals. We made them.
What do you mean by pre-made meals? You can't microwave.
You buy beans and you just heat them up and you eat them. Or you buy.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's what we did when I was camping as a kid. And or you buy, you know.
You buy beans and just,
or beef jerky and beans. That's what I would eat camping all the time. So you have to cook anything except for the beans. You have to heat them up, or not, or you can just buy cans of SpaghettiOs or something like that. Just open it up, eat it. Now, when you're backpacking, though, when you're backpacking, it's even easier. You just buy little. I mean, like, I bought packets of oatmeal. Those little flavored packets of oatmeal, and you know, if you're going like on a 2 week trip, you have. You can get a whole bunch of those little things in there, and they're really inexpensive, and or ramen or something light, and there you go. You're set for the week or however long you're out. But no, you have to have a tablecloth and candles, which
we always take candles, and we take real dishes.
So the average dinner prep would have to be in at like what, 2?
Yeah, well, we shifted. We didn't have lunch. We had supper, and so we had to start cooking it in the afternoon.
Right.
But we were also asleep in our tents by like 7:30 or 8.
When the sun went down,
because of our agrarian lifestyle. And the rest of the camp, people camping around us, did not do that. So we would lie on the cold, hard floor of the tent listening to other people.
Banging around.
Listening to ball games and talking loudly. And yeah. So, and then we were up with the dawn trying to make our kids be quiet for like 3 hours in the morning while other people were sleeping in. So that was, no, I had a really good time. I really love washing dishes the old fashioned way, heating water on the stove. And
that's right. We couldn't take any. We had paper plates.
We had one stack, which we used for lunches.
Real plates, which also seemed irrational to me. We could have had just thrown away instead of washing all the dishes all the time.
No, we washed all the dishes that we cooked on and we ate on. And it meant boiling a lot of water. And we only took one small teapot, which is a crisis, instead of two normal-sized ones. And so we were constantly boiling water and filling the teapot because everybody wanted tea. And we forgot the tongs. We forgot a lot of stuff because I needed like 6 weeks to really prepare for this. But I couldn't nail you down. I couldn't get you to agree that we were going to even go.
It was like people go on safari in Africa and they have like the servants who come.
Glamping.
And they set up these
beautiful tents.
Beautiful, yeah, right. And they have tea at the right time, mm-hmm. dinner at the right time, and they set off.
Except in this case, I was the servant. We had to do it. I made a lot of this go. You put the tents up, and then you did dishes twice with a lot of sobbing. I felt like you had real tears. Well, I cooked a couple times.
You did a couple times, that's right.
But I would have cooked more, but you were...
That's not me scratching or scratching. That's the dog scratching just to...
Because they're with us. We didn't take the dogs.
Right.
Much to my sorrow. I think they would have enjoyed camping.
Right.
So, no, it was very nice. It was the mental break that I wanted. Yeah, there was an evening skunk.
Oh, I'm so glad we didn't have the dog with
us. The daily visitation of the evening.
That skunk would have sprayed one of our dogs.
Yeah. Every night it came waddling up into the camp at 9 o'clock or 8 or something.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as it got dark, and it would come, you know.
Skunks aren't really afraid of.
No, it wasn't afraid at all. It came waddling up, ready to see what there was, and you chased it off night after night. It was kind of perilous. I felt super anxious about that. And then there was something else. It must have been the skunk snuffling around our tent every night.
It was. I left out. I had to go to the bathroom at night, and I looked out before I did, and there it was.
There it was. Checking things out.
Yeah.
He was very cute.
Yeah.
You know, you can have pet skunks. You just remove that.
The gland.
Gland, and apparently they're very friendly. We should get one.
Yeah, I didn't like the skunk. I'm not a fan of skunks anyway.
Well, so now you're happy that our week of camping is over, and I'm sad.
Yes, my back feels better. Have you slept in this bed?
No, now? I mean, I've had a hard time sleeping since we've been back. Mm-hmm. I think that we should get rid of some of our electricity. And we should, I guess I don't mind the water, but we could get rid of the dishwasher for sure. And the washing machine and just wash clothes in big tubs. And
why do you like it? Why do you like that stuff?
Because I know how to wash dishes. And if I've done that, then I've done it. It's complete.
Well, you can put it until the next too.
Meal, but you're not really washing the dishes. No.
It's made to do that. In fact, that's its life purpose.
But you're not really washing them.
Dishes. And your life purpose is not to wash dishes. Well, maybe it is.
Well, it's something I know how to do. I can do it just as well as the dishwasher. Whereas every other aspect of life, all the other work that I have in front of me is something that can never be completed. It's nebulous. It's sometimes hard to define. I can never know if I've done a good job. It's psychologically.
Well, if you've written a good article, you get lots of likes.
Well, yeah, that's true.
You know that you're a worthwhile person.
But if I don't get any likes, I have nothing.
Right.
Whereas if I've washed the dishes, I can look at the dishes and know that I washed them.
Right, but we don't have anyone over to see it, so no one will like it.
But I know.
You should take a picture every time you clean the kitchen. And post it on Facebook so that it counts.
So people know, yeah. Right. No, I don't need other people's approval. I need my own sense of satisfaction.
Oh, okay.
And everything that I write...
You're kidding for a minute.
No, everything that I write is terrible. So it's all bad. So I never get like a true sense of satisfaction. Even though I enjoy the process of writing, I don't get any kind of like... You know, eschatological.
I know people like attribute social media to the having the idea of, well, I've got to be a social person. I've got to have a platform. I've got to have people hear me and some others. But that's always been bound up with art, hasn't it? I mean, you don't. Yes, I know you enjoy the writing process, and I know the painter enjoys the painting process, and the sculptor enjoys the sculpting process. But it's always to be seen. You always want people to quote unquote like it.
You want people to be able to walk by and do a thumbs up as they walk by, or pay $1 million.
So that's kind of built into baked into the cake of being a writer or an artist.
That's fantastic that you conjoined writer and artist, and like conflated them into one thing.
Well, it's the same kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm gonna go ahead and assume that you just called me some kind of artist. Mm-hmm. Of words. I'm going to take that. That's fantastic.
Isn't writing a form of art?
It is. It is. That's wonderful. It's not sort of hack work at all. No, but the writing, I think any creative thing that you do like that, it deeply embedded in it is all the insecurity and self-loathing of the person doing the thing. And So you can look at a product, you can look at something you made, but it's not good. It's never good. It's never perfect. It's never complete. There's always something that you should have done differently or better.
Yep.
And so you never get a sense of completion about anything.
This is where preaching comes along. I think the same way as if you really care about preaching, if you just kind of write down your notes as the gospel is being read, then no. But if you really want to write a good sermon and preach a good sermon, yeah, because you have in your mind's eye what you want
to
say.
If you go back and listen to it, you're like,
I said this wrong. I had this.
Then you have to just leave it behind and do it again. So you're just building this mountain of
a failure.
Well, not failure, but half done work. You're doing your absolute best. You're working super hard, and with each sermon or each blog post, you just feel a little more insecure, a little more self-loathing. That is very different than doing the dishes by hand.
My only audience is our Lord Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So,
well, that's my, as long okay, as, mine too. As long as, mine too. I'm doing this all for the glory of God. I show up and write every day just because I love my Savior. Yeah. Neither of us are narcissistic at all. So I'm glad we established that. But what I was trying to say is that whole process of writing every day, which I really, really enjoy, is very different psychologically than washing dishes, boiling hot water in the stove, carrying it over, washing dishes in the sink, stacking them up, putting them away.
Because you can do that.
You can do it. It's done. You can do it to perfection. You did it. You can walk away, and then you can go back and do it again to perfection over and over again. And it's
wonderful. But it's an endless cycle of. The depressing part comes is when the minute you finish your perfect picture of the perfect kitchen, mm-hmm. the child walks in, or the dog walks in and pees on the floor.
Yeah.
Or the.
Yeah, that's true, but eventually the children are going to leave my house.
That's true, and the dog will one day go across the rainbow bridge.
That's a great poem. Sometime I think we should read it out loud for our listeners.
Yeah.
But so, well, anyway, I loved camping, and I'm stressed to already be back. Even though we have a week of vacation, I'm going to be spending the whole week doing work. This is not a week of vacation for me.
Well, I've got to get a sermon. So meaning, and I've got to mow the lawn.
Yeah, that sounds tough.
I've got a garden. Are you going to help me garden?
I'm going to be, like, cleaning my schoolroom.
That's right. You have a lot of work to do.
Freaking out. Because I'm going to start school next week. So help me. I am starting next week. So anyway, we weren't going to just only talk about this.
Yeah, we had some other topics.
We wanted to weigh in on all the news.
Right.
So which news is the uppermost part of your mind?
Let's see. Would you say that the Charlottesville, Virginia thing, or would you say? I mean, the problem with bringing it up is that the minute you do, there's already the backlash of everyone who talks about it now is virtue signaling.
Yes. Well, I was pleased. I mean, of course, it was so gracious of God to give me something to write about yesterday. Because I woke up and had nothing. Actually, I tried to avoid it all weekend, and then I gave up and read about it, and it outraged me enough to write. Yeah. But I didn't say on my blog, but I wanted to, that this is the best low-hanging fruit of the internet. Like, Christians can leap up and say, we're not racist, or we're not, you know, alt-right, whatever. And it's the easiest.
It's one of those few times when you can actually say something Christian and say something that everyone is going to agree with.
Yeah. It's like, I'm against the beating of small puppies.
Right.
I think that we should not.
All those who say we should beat puppies
are wrong.
Are wrong. So there is that coming. But I also... I mean,
so everybody got up and said it really full-throatedly, finally, because we finally could say something.
Right.
You know?
Well, but you have to... at the same time, I said this on Facebook, you have to, because in the mind of the secular person, I think all of these things, conservatism, Christianity...
Evangelicalism.
And Nazism kind of swirl together in this undifferentiated stew of things they hate. And
but that's that because they're badly educated and they don't know anything.
But that's why it's important, I think, for Christians to actually say publicly, look, this is, of course, unbiblical and wrong and stupid. And the whole point of the gospel is that identity, whether it's your worshiping your own kind of identity, which is, I think, what the left promotes. Who are you? And once you find out who you are, then that's you got to first figure out who you are, and then live into your discovered self, and that's going to save you. Or the right alt right identity, which is race. You know, you kin and culture and all of that being your
the
identity.
Earth.
And so what on the right happens is like people extrapolate a projection of themselves onto their color and worship it. So it's just a different form of self-worship, right? You worship yourself through your race as a Nazi. or you worship yourself as a genderqueer person.
A gender-fluid...
Right.
purple-lipstick young man.
I gotta
link that article. I will. There was a great article. About
so
how
the gospel just destroys both of those.
Yeah.
And says, no, we are our
but one of them
is our identity. We get there by faith.
If you stand up and say, I'm not for gender fluidity, you are a hater.
Right.
But when you get to stand up and say, I'm not for white supremacy, then you get to finally say, finally, I'm in the mainstream and everybody will love me.
Right.
And
but do you agree you have to say it or no? You have to say
no,
it.
No, I mean, I think you have to say it, but I do notice there's sort of, it seems like there's a quick emotional rush to be quick to, you know, talk about how evil racism is, but then it gets a little more reticent and depressed, you know, that the cries against abortion are not quite so full-throated often from Christians as it was this weekend. And I have been watching, I mean, when I said Americans, our children are just shouting.
I know.
When I addressed all Americans in my post as needing to not think that violence was a good idea, it's not just the white supremacy, it's the violence that the left is courting and encouraging, and Antifa and... Should I go in and say something?
No. Hey, guys, keep it down, please.
I'm sure they heard you say that.
I shouldn't have said please. Why do I say please?
Yeah. Would you mind just keeping it down? That's not how you should talk to your children.
Right. Because you don't ask them questions.
Mommy would like you not to speak so loudly. Is that all right with you? The better way, I'll just model it, is be quiet.
Right.
So the left courts violence. And they get away with it. And Christians haven't... I haven't read a ton of stuff about the from Christians. I have on sort of right, you know, left or right of center blogs online about the left just sort of flirting with violence, thinking that there probably isn't going to be any real bad repercussions if they let...
The anti-fascists
who are actually fascists. I mean, there's no real difference between anti-fascist and these white supremacists.
Right.
And there's that great video online of an Antifa rally, somebody standing up and reading from Hitler, and everybody
from Mein Kampf, yeah.
Applauding and changing the name so people don't realize that it's Hitler. I'm sorry. But Hitler was a fascist.
Yeah.
So at your anti-fascist rally, you should not be applauding a fascist. It feels strange that I have to say that out loud.
You should link that video.
I have to go find it again. So, I mean, there's not... But, you know, we were all really happy to finally be able to bash white supremacy. But I'd be interested to see Christians saying...
Well, I don't think we have to link too far behind. I think, remember the Black Lives Matter controversy, right? So when... and I got in trouble for this
weren't a ton of Christians who were saying this is a good...
Christians should not embrace Black Lives... The movement Black Lives Matter, the principle Black Lives Matter, sure. Or the slogan, sure. But the organization... itself, which
isn't for Black lives.
No, they promote they're promoting abortion. They're promoting
gender fluidity.
Yeah, gender fluidity, and there are some principles within the organization itself that are just as racist as the white supremacists are. They're just in a different direction, right?
So in a direction that everybody's
right
more. Maybe more comfortable with, right. Or but, you know, not willing to say anything about because it's not as easy. You know,
right.
Decrying white supremacy is the easiest thing that happened
right
this week.
Yeah. Well, the hypocrisy is seen in the Christians who, on the one hand, got angry with Christians who were pointing out that the organization Black Lives Matter is a racist, murderous. marriage blaspheming organization, but who are now during the Black Lives Matter controversy, the Christians who were coming after us,
yeah,
are in the front of the bandwagon going after the alt-right.
Yeah,
and so there's a
you should be against both.
Both, right? Exactly. Both are anti-gospel institutions.
Yeah. So.
Or organizations.
I mean, the problem is, I also think Christians are beleaguered and tired of being called out to, you know, at some point it gets tiresome to have to say, I'm against that. You know, there's a quick,
right.
Where are the Christians? Where's the outrage? They must all be outraged. And that happens every other day. And so after a while,
yeah.
I think, it does make me feel like a puppet on a string.
Oh, if you have to say something about everything, kind of.
Yeah, if you don't say something, then that means you're for it, you know. Right. And this all weekend, I thought, well, this is the dumbest rally ever, and how ridiculous that people are saying. Well, what do the Christians think? Go to church for a minute, and you'll see the Christians are not
right
on the side of these wackos. These are stupid, circular thinking young people who needed to be disciplined as children.
But some of them are identifying as Christian. That's a problem. The some on the alt-right.
But are, not really, not, like Christian-ish.
Well, they call themselves kinists. You know what a kinist is? It's someone who, it's a Christian who believes that that part of living life as a Christian has to do with maintaining the boundaries between races.
Yeah, I read about that this morning.
Right. Yeah, it's sick. It's a heresy. And a lot of the people who are also white nationalists are kinists. And so they'll say things to interviewers or reporters who go cover the event that sound Christian-ish. And to the undiscerning person who doesn't know anything about Christianity, look, the Christians are in this thing.
Except that apparently evangelicals put Trump in the White House, which is also completely specious because the average person who claims to be a Christian in America today is not really an evangelical. They might go to a Joel Osteen church, but that's not evangelicalism. And they might, you know, the pool of actual Christians is much smaller than those that claim to.
Which is why it's important to differentiate, right? That's why I think is the difference between virtue signaling and, I said this on Facebook, truth proclaiming.
Okay, but right there you're wrong because you can't say truth proclaiming, just like you shouldn't say God honoring. You can say proclamation of the truth is different from virtue signaling.
You can say this. If the first part of your sentence is virtue signaling.
Nope, you still shouldn't. Then you say you're
the truth proclaiming just becomes a parallel of that virtue signaling.
You shouldn't, because it sounds awkward and bad.
No, it doesn't.
It really does. And
I thought that was a great post.
And you should not say God honoring. You shouldn't use the word impact.
You don't know what you're talking about. Because this is, you're not, did you see my post?
I did.
Did you, liked it, didn't you?
No, I don't. I didn't push like. You used the word truth proclaiming.
It's not, it's two words.
It's super, super awkward and...
It's not awkward when you have virtue signaling in the first
part. No, it really
is,
and you shouldn't have done it. So I didn't, I don't think I pushed
it. You don't know what you're talking, you're not a good writer.
Well, you're not good at doing dishes when you can.
I'm a better writer than you.
Yeah.
That's one thing we've noticed. My writing is always very, it's just kind of choppy, and I say things, I just write things.
I write, you need and that
your writing
meme,
is beautiful.
I write things, I write all the things.
Right, and your writing is beautiful, and mine is just...
Well, that's very nice.
It's kind of like you're... It's kind of like a difference between a factory worker who's like churning out little statues. That's me. Little different, you know, and you're the statue, you're the sculptor, you write these things. So.
What are you trying to get from me? Like, what? Did you do something terrible that, like, later you're gonna, I'm gonna be mad about, and so you're laying a foundation of flattery, flatterer?
Here's our garbage truck. It's
yes. It's time.
Right on time.
So.
There it goes.
Well, okay, but we both agree that white supremacy is bad, and being a Christian is good.
Well, we also agree that, you know, black supremacy or Hispanic supremacy or whatever kind of supremacy is bad. And the problem is that everyone's looking for human solutions to the sin problem, right? That's, everyone's looking for, what's the problem with society? Well, from the kinist perspective, it's, well, there's too much inbreeding of races. And if all the races can be separated in...
So that we have, like, more and more birth defects.
Right. You know, from the black supremacist, what's the problem? Well, white oppression. The white, from the feminist perspective, what's the problem? Well, it's men, male oppression. And from the gospel's perspective, what's the problem? It's sin. And no philosophy is going to deal with that. No racial ideology, no political ideology, no government is going to be able to deal with that. Only Christ can deal with that. So all these other ideas about what might deal with it are really false and lies that God, or that Satan has foisted on us to keep us blinded to the truth.
Keep us down.
Yeah.
It's Satan,
he's
man.
The he's
Satan's the oppressor.
Well, he is. He's a servant, but he's not, you know, we help him.
So speaking of Satan, did you want to talk about churches that lost their property? And I can never remember, is it North or South Carolina?
In South Carolina.
South Carolina.
Yeah, they had been in South Carolina. The diocese left the Episcopal Church several years ago, and they didn't know whether they were going to join the ACNA or not. They just joined the ACNA a couple months ago.
Is it because they joined the ACNA that they...
No, the lawsuit was ongoing.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure if that played any role in the actual outcome, but so they lost their property in a decision that's being repealed, appealed. They're going to try and take it to the Supreme Court. But, you know, it's up in the air whether the Supreme Court is going to take the case at it or not. And if it does... Who knows how they rule? South Carolina had a pretty good argument, I thought, because they're the Dennis canon.
What are people doing? But this is like unprecedented.
Well, they're crushing branches. It's not the garbage truck. It's the
they're doing it right now outside of our house.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't have any yard pickup.
But our across the street neighbor did.
Wow, it's like they just settled in and moved, changed their address, and now this is our new normal.
Maybe we should pick a different time to...
We are gonna change the time of taping our podcast.
Right.
Because there's some better technology in another location. And so we're gonna avail ourselves of that.
Yes.
After this week. But I didn't realize it was gonna be a full-throated, like all the branches in Binghamton were gonna be crushed outside of our house.
I know. Well,
all right, so.
What were we talking about
before? South Carolina.
Yeah, okay. So the Dennis Cannon is what the. Is the. Was passed in 1979, which said that. By the General Convention in 1979, which says that all property is held in trust for the diocese in which a certain parish is located. So there's nothing in the Dennis Cannon that indicates that the diocese itself is the property of the diocese itself is then also held in trust for the national church. That's not something that was part of the Dennis Cannon. So a diocese leaving the Episcopal Church, the argument was, has a better chance of keeping all the parish property associated with that diocese than maybe an individual church does. We found that out when we lost our church.
Mm-hmm.
But South Carolina had a great claim because they were actually constituted as a diocese before the national church was. So legally, it seemed like the South Carolina...
They should have been able to do whatever they wanted.
Right. But anyway, they lost, and a lot of people... So beautiful historical churches have been having to hand over to... Being handed over to heretics.
I'm just curious about what they're going to do with all those buildings, because...
Yeah, they don't have the people for them. And the thing that really burns me is that it's Skip Adams, who's...
Yeah.
Our bishop, who... was in charge of trying to destroy our church and Tony Seale's church and other churches in Central New York, and in the process, cut the attendance of the overall diocese in half.
Closed churches all over the place because
not because
just
of their conservatism, but because
right,
losing,
they were just
right.
too small, and so they had all kinds of deconsecration. Whatever they are called.
If you look at the stats, the Diocese of Central New York lost more people, attendance-wise and membership-wise, than
almost any other...
Yeah, most dioceses around the country in the last 15 or so years.
Skip Adams was a real... I'm searching for a word.
Liar?
Treat.
Well, he lied to us. I mean, I pray for his repentance, but he really lied to us in setting us up for... the lawsuit. He kind of put us in the right.
He led us into
a certain.
But place. I mean, he's just.
And now he's the diocese. Now he goes right to South Carolina, and they win the lawsuit. Now he's in charge of dealing with those properties that they won. I think there's an injunction now. But what do they do with them? Because they don't have the people who occupy them now are no longer part of the Episcopal Church. They have to decide: are we going to stay in our buildings, or are we going to go with the ACNA? And even though their church may have already decided to do the ACNA, but now that the loss of the building is a very real potential, if the Supreme Court doesn't take the case, they have to decide: okay, are we really committed to the ACNA, or are we really committed to keeping our historic, beautiful church?
If they are, pushed out, though, all those buildings. What, do they become nightclubs? Do they become
mosques?
Mosques?
Yeah, the beautiful mosques, sir. Right there in downtown Charleston. Nothing says the Episcopal Church more than...
Making a church building into a mosque.
Yeah.
I think we sound bitter.
You
sound bitter.
Crushing a church and turning it into a mosque. Well, it's you know, so much... The Episcopal Church and Islam have so much in common.
Your bitterness is... flowing as a wellspring.
They both teach the doctrines of hell, but just in different ways.
Well, I mean, I'd like to say that every single church that left, or that sued and got and lost its property, came out, on the upside, doing really well. We did. We absolutely landed better off. God was so faithful to us, but that's not always the case, and it doesn't mean that God, if your church leaves and then you struggle to find a place to worship and it dwindles and it's not an indication of God's disfavor. I know it can be so discouraging, though.
That's a good point. There are churches that have left and then it just didn't
go well. So it really means, you know.
Don't say I'm going to leave because that way we'll grow.
Yeah. It's not a one for one correspondence, but God is faithful, though, and I know He will take care of those who are being persecuted.
I was talking to a woman who went to yesterday a church, not our church, but a different church, who had been a founding member of that congregation back in, I think, the 50s or 60s. I can't remember exactly when it was founded, maybe the late 50s. And she was 91 years old, I think, and so she'd been there from the beginning. And that's one of the parishes that lost their buildings in our diocese. And it was terrible because they lost a lot of people, too. It was just a terrible time for them. They now have their own building, thanks be to God. But she was, you could see the kind of sorrow in her eyes over the losses over the years.
It isn't going from strength to strength and from glory to glory. You know, you don't get, you don't take a stand for Jesus and then get, you know,
The garland thrown around your neck.
Yeah, and everything going wonderfully for you, and you get huge numerical growth. I don't know how many, but many churches did go from weakness to weakness to weakness to weakness. And that doesn't mean that they did anything wrong or that God didn't love them.
Right.
So,
you just read. At the time of Paul's death, read 2 Timothy, the last letter that he wrote, it's, he's not feeling the worldly victory at that point.
Right.
At that point, because the churches that he's planted are under.
His best life now.
Right, are under threat, not just externally, but internally as well. And he's, he isn't, all he can rest in is that he's preached the gospel and he's done what God called him to do, and he doesn't know what God's going to do with these churches or what God's going to do with...
Yeah, if they're going to survive.
Right. I think he perfectly trusts that the church will survive, but not every...
Individual
congregation. He doesn't know, but he's...
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we have to...
That's...
Look at things.
That's our encouragement.
Yeah.
That's our word of hope
for the church. If everything dies, it's okay. Because...
It doesn't mean that God doesn't love you.
Yeah.
It probably will feel like it, but... So, well, did you have other news stories that you wanted to... Did you want to talk about North Korea?
I did a little bit, just because it's really weird to have Twitter used by our president to lay down threats against Kim Jong-un. Well, they're defensive threats, because, Kim said he's going to... destroy Guam or something, and then
I don't think he said it on Twitter. He said it in
right to a speech or whatever. But then
the fire and fury.
But Twitter. Now our president said that. Our president said, "Yeah, try it, and we'll unleash fire and fury or something."
The world has never seen.
I guess if we did unleash our entire nuclear arsenal, there would be fire and fury, such as the world has never seen.
It seems a remarkable thing to say.
Some people are saying, he's just speaking the language that Kim Jong-un speaks, and if you're dealing with a crazy madman who thinks he can just get away with whatever, you need to be crazy and mad in return. So that the North Koreans looking at Trump might say, hey, I don't know what he's going to do. He's got this, he's behind the wheel of the car, and he could turn left or right, or he could just crash it into a tree. We don't know what he's going to do, so it does breed a sense of fear. Someone's really maniacal.
That's what the game North Korea is playing, though. They're hoping to play the crazy card so that people will leave them alone.
And so Trump's saying, oh, I'm just as crazy as you are.
You haven't met crazy. You think you're crazy?
What was it? The Federalist podcast was talking about the bro culture and...
Yeah.
So Kim Jong-un makes this crazy, irrational move, threatening to send intercontinental ballistic missiles toward the United States, and Trump says, hold my beer.
Yeah. I'm gonna do that, and I'm gonna flip over and like land in the pool on my head.
Right. So anyway, the one thing I wanted to talk about mostly about was just the same guy, the same pastor down in Texas, who had that flag idolatry service, the 4th of July, I think it was the 4th of July, or what, maybe it was later than that. But
yeah, Independence Day, whatever.
It was a service and celebration of America on Sunday morning.
What better time, though?
I just, look, I love this country, or at least what it should be. I don't love it now because of the systematic murder of babies and continued blaspheming of marriage and destruction of God's created order that we're engaging in, which makes us not one country under God. I'm sorry, or one nation under God. But so anyway, I don't think that the church has any business celebrating America or promoting patriotism within an actual service of worship. But that's what this guy did. Jeffries is his last name. He said, well, God has given Trump the authority to launch thermonuclear war against North Korea.
That sounds fantastic.
Based on Romans 13, right? Because Romans 13, because Paul said that God has given us rulers. He's appointed every ruler that rules, and with the purpose of punishing the wrongdoer, the evildoer, with the sword. So therefore,
that's great.
I agree. Like, mm-hmm. As far as when it comes to defending the innocent and the weak using the sword, that yes, governors have that power. But launching thermonuclear war, I would say, is not
defending
the weak. Because the weak are going to be incinerated by a thermonuclear war. They're going to die. And so that Romans 13 doesn't give you the authority in punishing evildoers to also
destroy the earth.
Millions and millions and millions of people who are innocent. Not innocent in a worldly sense.
I get the sense, though, that all the people who, this brings me back to the left and the right, the extremes of left and right thinking that violence is totes fine, that people don't really, because we live in such a safe and pleasant and quiet world in the West, and people aren't, you know, there's not El Shabaab or whatever it's called holding up buses and taking everybody off and shooting the Christians here. That when you say nuclear war, it doesn't really have any kind of emotional impact because people aren't being sarin gassed right now on the streets of Binghamton.
Right.
This preacher who's down in, where is he, in Dallas, you said? You know, Dallas is very quiet. It's very, you know, the crime factors down there are not that alarming. You can go to sleep in your bed at night. We remove the murder and killing into these, you know, low hung
right.
buildings where they have the word pregnancy resource center on the outside.
Right.
So it's sort of clinical, and you don't see the blood and the death. You just see people going out and coming in and going out. And so I really
But they don't have any moral value because
that was wonderful. But I really don't, because hot water comes out of the tap and nobody has to go camping, life isn't brutal and short. The calculation for violence isn't genuinely and rightfully considered because people don't have to deal with violence in their everyday lives right. or disease, right. or avalanche or death. And so, I think Americans are rather too quick right now to say, let's beat each other with sticks, or let's go to war with North Korea. Not all Americans at all.
No, lots but those of in people, the radical fringes yeah, think they want
they think they want violence,
and they don't want violence.
And I think a lot of people in the middle are saying, let's not do that. Who have read history and do read the news from other parts of the world, but not enough people who could control, who could have influence over those right and left wings are
doing that,
are pausing.
You know, I don't think Trump's alt-right. I don't think he's a racist. I don't think he's...
I don't know anything about
him. I don't think any of those things.
He doesn't sin, so he must be good.
But I do think that he, some of the language that he uses has encouraged, not intentionally, but has encouraged the alt-right and the white supremacy thing. He's some of the language he uses about aggression or immigration and taking our country back and making America great again. That's the kind of rhetoric you do see on the far, 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 I hate to even say right, but the...
Yeah, it's not really...
It's alt, on the alt-right. When they're talking about nationalism and kin and blood and soil, that's the kind of language that...
Thor. Aren't they? They're sort of pagan. Well, there's
some pagans involved in it, right? Right. Not all of them, but some are pagans.
But it conjoins itself with, you know, even...
Nordic
the
gods.
The Nordic god, the earth.
Yeah.
Tree. The world tree.
Yeah.
The rainbow bridge. Isn't that a Nordic thing? Isn't the rainbow bridge?
I don't think so. Maybe so, but I know the world tree is, but not.
I'm gonna look it up. I think it might be. I think you might be wrong.
But in any case, I'm not, everyone who's listening to this podcast knows that I'm a conservative, and so is Anne. But we're not necessarily
right here.
Trump fans.
Yeah, I'm a Trumpster.
Woo! I don't get on the Trump train. And there's this kind of weird blind loyalty to the man that's idolatrous on the right. And you see it.
But I mean, I saw it when Obama was president. There were people who just loved him.
Absolutely. Well, they sung hymns to him.
So, I don't know that it's...
Oh, I do. There are people who are calling... He's an answer to prophecy. He's a... He's the winged victory chair of God.
I mean, but the average Trumpster isn't... that crazy.
I don't know. I don't know. The average person, average Christian Trumpster who tends to connect patriotism and Trump and Christianity into one nexus of thought. So like Janet Mefford, the whole Janet Mefford thing
that was so creepy.
With James White. I mean, she and Brandon House and all those guys are, and Janet Mefford's mainstream evangelical. And with her, it's about America and fighting Islam and supporting Trump, all bound together in one little weird sick ball that leads her to hate the fact that James White has a conversation in which a Muslim imam or teacher shares what Islam means while he, in contrast, shares the gospel.
Right.
Right.
That was super disturbing.
Right, right. But there's this kind of blind zeal on the part of average Christians who become Trumpsters. Not just people who voted for Trump because they didn't want Hillary to come on, but the actual Trumpsters.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people voted for Trump because of Hillary.
Right.
And that's
fine.
Fine. But it brings me, can we end on this?
Yeah.
It brings me... I'm almost done with the badass librarians of Timbuktu, the people who got all of the manuscripts that were in Timbuktu out ahead of while Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb had taken over and imposed Sharia law and before they were pushed out by the French. I've got two more hours on this book, and it's really tough to listen to because it's Molly, and I feel really, you know, like it's emotional for me to listen to it. But you know, everybody in the book is essentially Muslim, you know.
Hmm.
But the gradations and the differences between the kind of Islam of Al-Qaeda and the kind of Islam of the people who were living in Timbuktu and Gao, who were sort of Malian and, you know, not not Al-Qaeda, you know, is really subtle. It just takes some untangling in it. It would be the same if you, excuse me, when you talk about Christians. You know, I don't want to be lumped together with Joel Osteen Christians, you know. I don't think he's a Christian. But when people talk about Christianity,
right,
it all gets lumped together. But there are complex threads that run through the Christian landscape. And so also for Islam, immigration issues. I know the social media world drives this simplification and this, you know, get purity of thought, get on the right side, say the right thing right now, make sure that you signal where you land, otherwise you're over, you're done. Which I really more and more am inclined to just dig my heels in and refuse to do that kind of, you know, there shouldn't, the pure, you know, express the pure thought now or you're done. Is kind of how, you know, Al-Qaeda operates. And that's not good. We shouldn't demand that of each other. We shouldn't demand virtue signaling as a way of being in or out. People should be allowed to be wrong. They should be allowed to be have opinions that
in or out of what? In or out of what?
Well, like in and out of their job, maybe. Oh, or okay. In and out, you know, pushed out of life in a communal sense. There's this if you say the wrong thing on Twitter, you can lose your job. Mm-hmm. And again, your life can be over. I mean, you're not going to be literally killed, but there's such shaming and consequences for having the wrong opinion. That's really dangerous, you know.
I mean, I agree with you to the point, and I think that's right. I mean, it's for, we were talking about social belonging. Yes, I agree. But I mean, I think it's important for pastors to, again, be truth proclaiming.
I'm not talking about pastors. I'm talking about culture.
But the language of virtue signaling and all that kind of stuff gets mixed up with this, because yeah, I agree. But you shouldn't have to say something
in order to be a human being. Like, you shouldn't have to rush out and say I'm against white supremacy,
right?
Or you're done, you know. But there was this, like, you better get out there and say it. You better get out, you know, and be against this right now.
But aren't there some times when the Christian has to do that?
Absolutely. But I think that in civil society, there should be room for the Christian to be wrong. There should be room for the civil person engaged in civil society to be wrong. Christians should, you know, be a little gracious to each other. If you didn't say the right thing at the right moment, is there forgiveness for you? Can the blood of Jesus cover your sins? You know, and that. But it's increasingly, even among Christians, it's getting this, like, polarized, simplified, outrage driven, and it's not going to end up in a good place.
Right.
You know, we need to be willing to hear a thought that's longer than 140 characters. You know, the best thing for virtue signaling is Twitter, because you have to lay it all out there. You can't nuance it for a paragraph and a half and sort of embed your virtue in a longer thought. You have 140 characters, so if you're going to virtue signal, blam, you get out there, you deliver it, and then people know where you are. And it's terrible.
If you say it well enough, then your virtue signaling can be the virtue signaling of everyone else. They can retweet it,
and then they don't even have to craft your own 140 tweet. Anyway, I really recommend this book if you liked suspense, which I don't. I don't like suspense, so I'm like on the edge of my seat for the badass librarians. But if you like books, and you like libraries, and you like suspense, and you like Molly, you're going to love this book. That's a narrow... Anyway, you're looking at me like you don't want to read it.
I do want to read it.
You just read a, like, million-page book on the French Revolution.
It was awesome, I have to say. It was one of the best books I've read. Well, actually, I've listened to it, and it was a large number of pages, and it was. What was interesting is how language worked in the French Revolution and how we see it working now and on social media. You know, you could denounce somebody, and the words and your that was it for that person.
Yeah.
During the worst parts of the terror, if you spoke well, if you had your sophist rhetorical skills honed, and there was a code of language, you know, you're talking about citizenship and talking about the...
You had to use the right language in
that. Yeah, there's a code of language, just like we have, very coded. And if you say it the right way, at the right time, against the right person, you can have that person guillotined. Yeah, you can... It was during the Romantic era when, I mean, the romance idea was huge in the French Revolution, which was this idea that the truth... is really expressed emotively. your feel, the true feelings,
all the feels.
It was there, and both individually and also corporately. So Rousseau, this whole idea of the people come together and emote a certain way. That's the truth. That's anyone against that is against the truth, the people. And the horror of absolute democracy, which is that, you know, if you get a majority that votes for your death, that's kind of what Rousseau was going for, because his idea was that's where truth is found. And Rousseau and Voltaire and all those guys were really influential during the revolution. But you see the same kind of thought process going on. Of course, we don't guillotine anyone yet, but we guillotine them socially.
Yeah, we cut them out.
Yeah, right.
And then we flirt with violence on the margins, right. And that's not a good thing.
I'm trying to remember the name of the book I was reading.
Well, you can give it to me and I'll
Citizens
link
is the
it.
Name of it. I forgot the name of the book. The author, Shira, I think.
I'll link it in my...
Okay.
Well, that was really, as usual, encouraging.
Yeah.
And maybe the world will still be here next week when we decide to podcast again. We won't have had nuclear... Holocaust, but so we hope that we'll see you next week, and until then have a great time on Twitter, virtue signaling.